Welcome to another episode of The Last of the Action Heroes podcast, a part of The Last of the Action Heroes podcast network. As I've said before, this podcast show is kind of like, I'm going to say the flagship, because a flagship would denote some sort of a quality or consistency, but it's kind of like the show that could do whatever it wants. That's probably, it's the rogue show, or it's the, we get to pick whatever film we want, whatever actors we want from whatever year. We're not beholden to any one actor. Like, obviously it's not Schwarzenegger films, or Van Damme films, or James Bond films, or Stallone films. It's all the others. It's kind of like the mishmash, pishposh of films, and I usually like to try to pick films, A, that I haven't seen. So it's very selfish for me personally in some ways, because I think so far every episode I've reviewed has been a movie that I haven't seen before, so I watched it for this podcast. But with me today is somebody I've podcasted a few times with, Craig of the Slycast. How you doing?
All right, Ryan. Hey, I'm so glad that this happened, because it shows that every once in a while Twitter does work, because I tweeted about this movie and then I guess you saw the tweet and asked me if we wanted to talk about it, and you knew my answer immediately. And I want to say, I hope we're on the same page here, because if not, I think we're going to have to reconsider our friendship.
I'm surprised you haven't reconsidered our friendship long before this recording. We'll get to that. We'll get to my thoughts and feelings on the film, but let's talk a little bit about how we got here. Yeah, so I did see your tweet. Now, FX is a film that, of course, I have seen the cover of this film on video store shelves my whole growing up years. It is a it's a film that sort of intrigued me. I knew nothing about it. I went into this film blind. I had no idea what it was about. I only knew that Dennehy was in it. I'm a big Dennehy fan, I guess you could say, of his performance, of course, in First Blood. I've seen a couple of his films, but I've never seen a Dennehy film because he's in it. But every time he pops up, you're always like, oh, Dennehy's here. Cool. This film was no exception. He was amazing in this film. I'm starting to get to think that Dennehy might just be a good actor. That being said, FX is a film that I've seen the cover. I know it's kind of talked about. I think it may have a cult following or what have you, but I never knew anything about it. Now, talking about the films for this podcast, I've always said I want to watch films I haven't seen before that are kind of interesting to see. And FX was actually one of those films, because it's a film that I know people enjoy, but I haven't seen. And two, it was free on Tubi. Now, the funny thing is, when you put that on Twitter, I'm saying, oh, great, I got a co-host, Craig, let's do FX. And you're like, great, watch it as soon as you can, because it's the last day on Tubi. Well, I didn't get a chance to watch it on its last day on Tubi. So our friend, our pirate friend Andy, he sent me his own personal copy, which I immediately mailed back to him after he sent it to me in the mail. So that's the copy version we're going to be watching today. Had I rented this from YouTube or whatever, it would have been money well spent. This was a fun movie, Craig.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know, in Canada there, do you have Pluto TV?
Probably that's the NBC, that's their streaming service, correct, or no?
It acts like a cable service. So basically there's different channels, you know, and there's like show specific ones. So there's like Unsolved Mysteries channel, where 24 hours a day it just shows episodes of Unsolved Mystery. But they do have an on-demand section, and they also do have like an 80s rewind movie channel, which is where I caught this the other day. But you can still pull up FX and its sequel FX2 on Pluto On Demand. But I also noticed when we were talking about this that the dual Blu-ray that was released back in February was under $10 on Amazon the other day. So I ordered it. It got here maybe on Saturday. So I was able to watch the movie again in that beautiful Blu-ray resolution, and then also watch some of the bonus features. There's a making of from 1986, so it's more like a promotional puff piece. Right. And there's also a pretty modern, I don't know what year they filmed it, a new interview with the director that's about 15 minutes long, which was really good. I was actually kind of bummed that they didn't get him to do a commentary track. But either way, if you're listening to this and you have access to Pluto TV, it is available on Pluto On Demand. And the one thing I do like about Pluto as opposed to Tubi is they're both ad supported, of course.
Right.
But the Pluto TV ad breaks seem to make more sense. Sometimes on Tubi, like, it'll just cut to a commercial right in the middle of it, like a scene.
Well, I would recommend getting something called AdGuard for your browser. And it actually works for Tubi. So I can watch Tubi movies and TV shows with no ads, or any streaming service that is free.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's called AdGuard. Yeah. And here's a little secret about AdGuard. You get 1 month free, and then a little thing will come up and say, hey, your free thing's over. Would you like to subscribe? Here's a little pro tip. Just click on the...
Say no.
No, well, yeah, well, you say no, but you don't say anything. You just click on the message box, just close it, and it never goes away.
Okay, cool. Well, I use Tubi. I have like an app on my TV, the Tubi app on my TV. So I don't think you can use any of those ad blockers or whatever on.
No, this is like a browser supported, so PC. So I watch this Tubi stuff and some other like streaming services where they're quote unquote free, which they are free, but with ads. And again, with the AdGuard, I'll say this again, it's multi-country supported, browser. But yeah, I'd recommend using it again when that ad comes up or when it says, hey, but it works. I've never paid a dime, and it blocks ads from everything, from YouTube as well. Everything.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Now, FX actually does mean effects, as in special effects. Now, one of the producers and or director of this movie, I forget, or somebody behind the film.
Everybody.
Okay. you know what I'm about to say?
Yeah. The name of this movie was problematic.
Yes. Absolutely. I've never seen this film, Craig, because I didn't know what I was going to watch. I knew this film might be something kind of cool to watch, maybe. Even me as like a teenager back in the 80s and early 90s, seeing this film again on the bookshelf, on the video shelf, over and over again, I was like, I don't know if I have no idea what this is. Like FX, like is this a code word for something? Is this an acronym? Of course, you say it out loud. Well, it means special effects, but the alternate title, Murder...
Yeah, Murder by Illusion.
Murder,
or something.
You put Murder and Illusion in the title together, you're going to get a couple more eyeballs on your product.
Yeah. It's funny. I think it's referenced in that interview with Robert Mandel.
Okay.
Or Mandel. And also, I watched the Siskel and Ebert review of this, which is on YouTube. It's part of a full episode. I watched the full episode just because I love watching Siskel and Ebert chat with each other. Even Siskel and Ebert, as like film reviewers, knew that this movie had been branded wrong. And I forgot what the original title was. I know the original script did have a different title, but I can't recall what it was at this moment.
I thought
but,
it was Murder by Illusion. I thought that was the title. Was it not? Or?
It might have been, which is, yeah, like you said, that's an amazing title.
Murder and Illusion in the same title?
Yeah.
I'm there.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I guess this movie, it did all right. I mean, it warranted a sequel, and they actually made a Canadian TV series that ran for a couple of seasons where they recast everybody, you know, but it was still Roddy Tyler.
Yeah, that's crazy. They did have a 2-season TV show, which is more than some TV shows. In fact, they even got greenlit. It's pretty cool. And it was the same creators, writers were kind of handled the show, which I kind of like that despite it's not going past 2 seasons. At least the people that were in charge of the show were the people that were in charge of both films, which I kind of like that. I like that it's the same. I haven't seen the sequel or the TV show, but I just like, for those fans, it was probably nice for the fans to have the same brains behind the product.
Yeah, and actually, I don't know if you want to get into sort of the origins of this.
No, I don't want to talk about the film. Craig, let's...
Okay, okay.
Yes, tell me the origins.
Well, you're the host, so...
No, you're the co-host. In fact, we're equal. Yeah. In fact, you might be more of a host for this one, because you know this movie, and you highly enjoy this film. Like, when I came on to watch this is my first time I've seen the film. I've only seen it once. I just saw it in the last 24 hours, so it's very fresh in my brain. But this is a film you're familiar with, and you've seen more than... How many times?
I've watched it 3 times in the last week. Before we get into the backstory, I do want to say that it's refreshing... Is there's been so many instances where we've podcasted together, Ryan, and we've talked about a movie that came out in our youths.
Right.
Over the Top's a perfect example.
Yeah.
And the movie that you remember watching as a 12-year-old is not there.
Yeah, correct.
It's just not a good movie.
Are you agreeing with me then about Over the Top? Are we in agreement?
Yeah, I think okay. The last time we talked about it, I podcasted about that movie like 3 times, I think. Yeah, it's not a good movie.
It's not a good
movie. But with this movie, it was a case of being so happy that the movie that I watched and loved as a 12-year-old still entertained the heck out of me as a guy in his mid-40s. And that's really cool because, you know, they always say you can't go home, but this was a case of being able to go home, quote-unquote, to a movie from your childhood that still holds up. The origins of this, and I forgot the screenwriter's name, but he was an actor, and him and his partner wrote this, and they kind of pitched it as like a low-budget sort of movie of the week for network TV. some producers got a hold of it, including Dodie Fayed, who I think now we all remember for dying with Princess Di. Mm-hmm. He was in the car with her. But they saw that script and said, no, this is a movie. This is like a real legit theatrical movie. And it was developed as such. I'm so glad it was, because the sort of beats in this movie, they do have sort of a network TV movie feel to them.
Right.
But it's got a budget and it's well made. I mean, cinematographer was an Academy Award winner. Editor Terry Rawlings was an Academy Award winner. The score, which is a Stallone connection, I don't know if you caught that or not.
Yeah,
Bill Conti.
Of course, I saw Bill Conti did the score. I'm like, wow.
There is some major, major talent behind this. And I think the other thing that really works with this movie is the filmmaker or the director, Robert Mandel, was not an action movie guy. He wasn't a thriller guy. He actually had his roots in Broadway, and he made sort of just dramas. I think we've talked about this before. I think we talked about it when we did our episode on It's a Long Road, where you're covering the First Blood movie, doing a real deep dive on it. But anytime you can bring in a director who is able to do that character work, you can figure out all the action stuff later. And that's what second unit's for, and that's what you assemble a team for. You know, this is a good example of a movie that you wish that more thrillers or action movies hadn't just gone to, like, guys that are known for making action movies, because I think that's one of the things, one of the many things that sets this movie apart.
Well said. Robert Mandel, he was, yeah, Broadway director, and funny enough, he actually directed another film that I've already reviewed on this podcast show, The Last of the Action Heroes, The Substitute.
Okay, wow, I didn't realize he doesn't have a big filmography. He's got like five or six films, right?
I can't believe it. Two of the films that I've watched, I've done five films for this show.
Yeah.
And two of them have been directed by Robert Mandel, The Substitute and FX. I think it's fantastic. In fact, the actress who played the deceased girlfriend of Rolly Tyler, played by Diane Venora, who played Ellen, mm-hmm. who gets shot at the window, she was, I think, one of the teachers or something in The Substitute. So she came along to The Substitute as well with Robert. So they must have had a good working relationship or something, because she was an interesting actress as well. Diane Venora, she went on to do Ironweed. What's the Clint Eastwood one right afterwards? Oh, boy. It was like she became, or sort of was starting to build a buzz of becoming like a strong actress, and then her star just fell. I always find that interesting, the journey. Yeah, she was in Ironweed. Oh, and then Bird. Yeah, she was in that Clint Eastwood movie Bird.
Okay.
And I think it's called The Jazz or something like that. Jazz.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think he directed that as well. And I think she got nominated for quite a few awards, what have you. But then it just fell away. She just.
You know what, man? Anytime that happens with a female actress in the 80s, I assume there was some kind of casting couch nonsense that went on.
So she, like, maybe denied advances or something? Do you think that's what
I mean, that's where my head always goes anytime. Anybody gets fucked over in Hollywood.
But actors, too, you know, obviously. But it's just interesting how she, like, you know, going to Clint Eastwood film. And then she did have a little bit part in the movie Heat in 95. But if you look at her credentials, it just seems like it was, like, it peaked really fast. And then
she probably aged out, too. You know, I mean, that's another sad fact about this Hollywood in general is, I mean, you're only considered young and fresh for a very, very small amount of time. You know what I got to say? She should have just rocked that blonde wig for her whole career.
Yeah, she was much prettier with blonde hair. Is that terrible to say? I know when she was.
No. I mean, it's just an observation. I mean,
do you want to talk about the opening sequence? Might as well.
I finally understood this opening scene, because this kind of stuff always bugs me when movies do this, and I finally sort of cracked the code for myself. But these movies where you see a movie being made.
Okay.
But you don't realize it's being made until the director yells cut.
Okay.
It's always bothered me, because you know that's not how... They're not doing all these stunts at the same time,
Right,
But what I realized, Ryan, is when we watch the opening scene of that movie until the guy yells cut, we're seeing that completed scene cut together the way an audience would watch it.
That's a very good point. I never looked at it that way. So yeah, these opening sequence, what we have in this film, it is, for those who haven't seen it, who might be listening to this episode, well, I find that odd, but people do listen to our episodes, they don't watch the movies. So what happens at the very beginning of the film is we have this guy in a rain jacket, fedora on, what have you, gangster type outfit. It looks like it might be kind of olden times. Again, that actress, Diane Venora, who plays Ellen, she's wearing a blonde, almost like a, she looks like a Marilyn Monroe type character, you know? It's it might be the 1940s or 50s.
It's supposed to look like an old gangster flick.
Right. And this guy comes in. I guess this restaurant specializes in fish aquariums.
It's a big, huge lobster tanks. Enough lobster tanks to feed all of Manhattan.
Now, it looks like some of the lobsters were alive when they were blown up and landed on the floor. I always get, I guess this was the 80s, but I hate saying they wouldn't film that today, but the way PETA is today, I don't think they could have done that today with us. Every lobster would have to be like animatronic or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, or just CGI.
Or CGI, yeah. The classic aquarium breaking, that's been used in films how many times?
Oh, more than we can count.
Yeah, and this film does them all. It has like 20 that break. So the guy comes in and he just, you know, in light of today's or recent news of the time of this recording of mass shootings, is when I watched the sequence, I think it was actually the day of one of your nation's recent mass shootings there, Craig.
Yeah.
I say this not to be glib or to be a disingenuous what have you to the victims of these terrible tragedies, but that's the whole point. I watched this film, and it's amazing how much it just triggers even my brain recent events, because a guy literally just walks into a public place of, you know, fun and blows people away with a machine gun. Like, it's getting harder to watch that kind of stuff now in films. What do you think?
I'd agree, man. I mean, you know, you go to the movies to sort of escape things, and, you know, sometimes it just hits too close to home.
Yeah, the gunman shows no mercy. He blows away the patrons and what have you, and then he takes out this poor lady in the blonde wig. And now, again, I went into this movie blind, but I had a feeling that what we were watching was not the film. So I don't know what I was thinking now that I'm not trying to retcon my memory here. But I had a feeling something was going on here.
Yeah.
Knowing that the title had to do with quote-unquote special effects, I knew something was happening. But it was still kind of cool when the director yells cut and you see the carnage everywhere and everyone's asking, hey, how you doing? Or great job, you know, on your getting killed and the squibs and all that stuff. But like you said there, Craig, you watch the sequence, and there's just so much stuff happening between the aquariums breaking, people on the floor, and there's no camera on the floor or anywhere.
Yeah.
But you're right. We're seeing it as an audience member would see it in the theater.
Yeah.
Then we see it kind of pan up. And I like that overhead shot. It shows people putting out the fires and what have you. It's done like a one-take type thing when we know that film itself within this film, like the real-life filming of that sequence, probably was like 30 different angles and takes.
Every bullet hit and every explosion or whatever would be its own setup. But I think this is a great scene because it instantly sets up the world. It quickly introduces us to who Roddy Tyler is, what he does, and why ultimately he gets involved into this huge sort of conspiracy that he gets involved with. One other note is there was a lot of heavy hitters behind the scenes from special effects, you know, perspective as well, including, I think he was billed as being the consultant, maybe.
There was a Star Wars guy who won an Academy Award.
Yeah, John Steers, and he was credited as special effects consultant.
Yeah.
You had a guy from Star Wars working on this movie, yeah. So everything in this movie, I think their attempt was to sort of make it look as accurate as it could be in terms of how Hollywood would do something.
Yeah, I think they did. I think they did show us trade secrets. So it's like a film within a film. We're seeing this gentleman played by Brian Brown, who I'm not familiar with. I've probably seen
him. Oh, wow.
Yeah. You know who he looked like at first? I thought, is this him? But it's not. You know the Lannister older guy?
Yeah, like who gets Game killed? Of Thrones?
Yeah. He looked like him, like a younger version of him. So I thought that was him, but it wasn't.
Never saw Cocktail with Tom Cruise?
Oh, of course. I have seen it like twice. You know, but now that I see it, but yeah, he's the guy that trains Tom behind the counter. Okay, I see. Oh, wow. Anything else you can think of? Because, yeah, that comes back to memory now. But
off the top of my head, I do know that there was a point where Brian Brown sort of just threw in the towel on Hollywood and went back to Australia.
Okay.
And I think just continued to have his career there. And you know that there's tons of movies that are made internationally that, you know, never get talked about. I do know that Brian Brown was also big on a TV miniseries called The Thornbirds prior to this.
I've heard of the TV show. I haven't seen it, but there you go. So he's had he's been working his whole career. Like, he's never out of work, it seems like.
I think he's a great actor.
Yeah, he was good. I enjoyed him. Yeah. Like about it, too, is he's Australian, and they make mention of it, and that's it. And it's like, great, you're Australian, we get it, you're in America working, but you're Australian. And there is your accent, move on. I kind of like when movies do that. They don't try to hide it or pretend you don't have it. They just explain. They do it for Jean-Claude movies all the time, which I love. Like, hey, why do you have a heavy French accent? Well, you know, I was born in France, but I'm in America. Okay, cool. Well, let's get on with the movie then.
Although they do say he was deported from Australia for a movie he made. Like,
was it too brutal?
I guess the special effect was just too authentic.
Okay, so we should probably explain. So Brian Brown plays a guy named Roland Tyler, goes by Rolly in the film. Or Raleigh or Rolly, which one? I can't remember now.
I think it depends on how you handle the O.
Sure. So Rolly in the film. Here's my plot synopsis of this, if I was to tell someone. It's George Lucas and or James Cameron gone Rambo meets Home Alone. That's FX. Okay, it would be like the government hired George Lucas in the 80s to assassinate a mafia guy, and then you sprinkle in Home Alone.
No, absolutely. This movie gets right to it. As this scene is being shot and they're getting ready to do the next setup, we get the guy from the... What department is he?
Justice
Department, yeah. Well, he doesn't introduce himself as that. He introduces himself as a producer.
Right.
He wants Raleigh to work on a movie for him. Basically set up an appointment the next morning.
He's got work for him to do, and of course, his girlfriend, who plays the Marilyn Monroe character, Ellen, she's like, hey, you're a producer. She kind of like hits on him right in front of him. I'll be in your movie, because I'm always looking for more work. Okay, so we have a little sequence here that's happening as we're watching this live here. So Raleigh takes a cigarette that somebody's smoking and puts it on his wrist. At first, I didn't catch why he did that and why he didn't flinch. I thought it was a fake cigarette, but it's the other way around. He's wearing a layer of skin on his wrist where he won't feel the cigarette. Is that right?
Yeah, and it's for the suicide scene.
That's right. That's what I mean about what I like about this film. It shows you some of these trade secrets. So we're seeing actual prosthetic type special effects and the squibs and what have you. I wanted to get back to that. So we're seeing that happen in the movie because that's part of the story in the movie, but that's how they do things to make those things. Like, how do they do those cigarettes, you know, putting on someone's skin? Well, it's not real skin. And it just shows you how great the makeup work is.
This movie was filmed in Manhattan, and you can tell it's filmed in Manhattan. There are so many great exterior shots of Manhattan. It's just cool to see because nowadays when you see a movie filmed in a city, a lot of times, you know, you get just generic establishing shots and then everything's super tight so you could be anywhere. It doesn't matter. But here, like that one shot, you see them getting in the car. You can see all the way down whatever avenue that is to the end of the island, which is just really, really cool.
Brian Brown, who plays Raleigh.
Those tidy whiteys.
Yeah, 1986. He's wearing the tidy whiteys. Got a nice little physique on him. He's 39.
Athletic, yeah.
He's 39 in this film. And Dennehy, when we get to him later in the film, Dennehy's 44, which I always... What is it with Dennehy looking like 20 years older than what he is? He's 48 in this film. 48. Like, great, great actor, but he just looks much older than what he really is. Is that the way it was back then, or am I just going crazier?
I think everybody just looked older. Probably a couple of factors. Mainly, probably the environment that we're in now, and also the processed foods that we eat that keep us looking young.
Yeah, we're full of processed food. And also Brian Brown, you know who else he looked like, especially later in the film when he's wearing the prosthetic with the beard? He looks like one of the actors in Harry Potter.
Yeah, okay.
Skinny guy who becomes like a, I forget what creature he was. Anyways, if I heard his name, I would know his name.
Jason Isaacs,
yeah,
maybe?
No, not Jason Isaacs. That was Draco Malfoy's father. He was a blonde-haired.
Not the dude from Dracula and True Romance and...
No. Okay, well, let us...
Element.
Tim,
yeah.
look up the Harry Potter. He's in the last film. he's in our Discord down. But anyways, Cliff DeYoung plays the agent here as part of the Justice Department. He's now gone to Raleigh's house, where, of course, in Raleigh's house, it's set up maybe like you'd imagine a guy who works in special effects, but it's kind of silly. This is a part of the film where it's sort of silly.
He lives in his studio.
But they treat it like a museum of sorts. When people come visit him at his house, they treat it like, wow, you got this. Oh, I remember this. Now, hey, speaking of Stallone, to be fair, Sly does the same thing. I know Sly in his cave, in his mansion, at least the one they used to live in before he sold it. I'm sure he's got it set up now again wherever he's going to settle. But he has Rocky and Rambo and other type of movie memorabilia and artifacts in his own personal home on display. So to be totally fair to the character in this film, that's probably not uncommon to have on display, especially things that you create with your own hands and brain. Like things that you've created, you would have on display. But the silliest thing that he has, though, is the moment you open the door, there's this Star Wars-like alien creature the size of a man, if not bigger. When you open the door, it growls at you and is supposed to startle you. And I'm just going to play that so people can actually at least hear it. Cliff DeYoung, who plays the agent, comes up the stairs and he opens the door and he's greeted to this creature.
sorry. Should have warned you about Rosebud.
Yeah, I guess so.
I used it to scare off burglars.
I can believe that. Wow.
Come on in.
Okay, I used it to scare off burglars. Now, there's two things going on here. Now, can he not just lock his door? Two, if a burglar comes in and sees that, it might give you a bit of a quote-unquote jump scare, sure, because let's say the burglar would enter in the dark, it's nighttime, you just hear a growl. It would give you a bit of a jump. Whoa! But once you realize this creature doesn't exist in our reality, you might start to figure out what's going on here.
This ultimately becomes the plot point, really. It's set up for later on. The cool thing I like about this is this dude from the Justice Department is research, because as they walk through the apartment, he picks out different gags from movies, and he's like, you know, I dismember Mama, or, you know, he did his homework.
Yeah, so we're led to believe he's a fan of his work, and I would suspect he probably hasn't seen all these films. He did his homework to get into his good graces for the request or favor he's about to ask.
Oh, my God. Song of the Succubus.
That's right.
I love these movie titles, he says. Yeah.
Planet of the Female Mummies.
Done your homework.
Yeah. Oh, God. Blood in the Basement.
Blood in the Basement.
Careful of that.
Oh, sorry. I Dismember Mama.
You know them all.
Yeah.
Is that a bong she's holding?
It is a bong, and he puts it upright for her. He says, I Dismember Mama. Craig, that was actually a real film.
Thought it was. It was too good of a name not to be.
It was filmed in 1972, so 14 years prior to this film. So somebody who wrote the script knew this film. And it's free on YouTube. I watched a little bit of it.
Is that dummy in it?
I didn't watch the whole thing. I just did a skip around. 1972, I Dismember Mama. So it might be a cult classic, something worth watching. Yeah, it's available on YouTube for anyone to watch. So make sure your kids aren't watching this. So he gets an offer here. The offer is for him, this special effects guy, to kill a mafia kingpin who's going to turn state's evidence and go into the witness protection program.
So basically, it's like you said, they have a guy that's high up in the mob, about to turn state's evidence. They want to fake his death or make it appear that he's assassinated. Now, the thing I didn't understand about this, Ryan, is I thought in order for you to go into any kind of protective custody or anything like that, actually, wouldn't he have had to have testified first?
Yeah, I was a little confused by the premise. The premise was they wanted to fake his death so it was believable enough that the people that he was going to testify against wouldn't kill him before he testified against them. This is one of the biggest flaws in the movie. Now,
actually, it really isn't, if you think about it.
So how I understand it is, well, why doesn't he just turn state's evidence right now and then go to witness protection program? Or even have him go turn state's evidence, then fake his death because he gave the evidence and now he's been killed by the rivals, but he's still, the whole idea of them dying before he turns it, that's what I didn't understand, because you have to do it in court. They faked his death before he gave the, or am I wrong about that?
Oh, no, you're not wrong, but here's the thing. We have to look at this from the villain perspective. So they didn't care if he ever testified. What they wanted to do was to make it look like he was dead so they could smuggle him out of the country and then split the $15 million that he had stolen from the mob. It's really Raleigh's fault for never questioning it. They show that Raleigh's not too informed on things because the guy asked him if he knows what witness relocation is, and Raleigh says no. But basically, they didn't care. They just wanted to make DeFranco look like he was dead. He would never have to testify. They could just skip town with him and then all collect the money together.
So they go to fake his death, but he never dies. The twist is that Raleigh thinks he's killed him for real, but he is actually in the fact alive. Everyone thinks he is dead indeed, but Raleigh's on the run that he killed him. Who was going to run with the $15 million? Was it going to be
Jason, this dude here, that's setting Tyler up? And that's basically it. And then whoever Mason Stooges were, he had like three dark op guys that, you know, had fake social security numbers.
Lipton, because the guy's name was Lipton, the Justice Department.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, they make the tea joke. Yeah. So basically, you can see that that's what happened, because there's that whole scene where Mason and Lipton are getting chewed out by the other guy from the, maybe the police, saying, how did he get out of custody? How did you let him slip away? Lipton offers to resign. It's all smoke and mirrors. It's police FX, if you will. So if Raleigh was a little bit more savvy in terms of understanding how the justice system worked, he probably wouldn't have gotten tricked like this.
So to play devil's advocate, wouldn't there have been an easier way to get the money?
I guess they could have just skipped town with DeFranco, but then DeFranco would have been constantly on the run. He would have been on a I'm sure the FBI's most wanted list. Bob would have still been looking for him. But if he's quote-unquote dead, there's no one to look for.
These two guys are already corrupt, Lipton and Mason. They could have just literally hired a hitman, killed him for $15,000.
He did the key, though.
Around his neck at the end of the film. I assume it was always on his person.
Now we're getting too deep into the weeds.
No, I know. I don't like to do that, but these are the things that just automatically... I never look for fault, but every now and then something will come up. I just think of it in real-life terms. Is there an easier way? And I think if I was a script doctor, if I was working in the industry and I was given this film, that's how I would have approached it. Some sort of light tweaking of like a 60-second piece of dialogue to why they couldn't just, you know, there's a reason the key had to be on him at a certain time, because like, the key is taken off him at the end. And that was how he used it to access the box. Well, we find out later that he needed to be alive to get the money. So how do you know, he faked his death. So I would assume they were going to take the money before he faked his death.
You just solved your own problem.
What's that?
They didn't have the FX ability that Raleigh has. So they needed him alive to get the money out. They could have killed him after, I guess, they got the money, but then they still need to get him out of the country. Talking about script doctoring, though, the interview with Robert Mandel on the new Blu-ray, he actually talks about some script work that they did. And it's a scene that we just watched where Raleigh finally decides to take the job. The original script, Mandel was... he wasn't convinced, or in the script, it's never made clear why Raleigh finally decides to do it. And they did a quick little scene where basically Raleigh turns it down and then Mason says, oh, we're going to get so-and-so to do it instead. And it basically, it's an ego stroke. And Raleigh says, that guy's not as good as me. He won't be able to do it. And that's what causes Raleigh to sort of make the decisions to go ahead and do the job. So I thought that was a cool little character beat, and it gave the director at least some justification instead of Raleigh just being like, sure, I'll do it. It was actually like Raleigh didn't want to do it, but he couldn't let somebody who was inferior to him have that opportunity.
All right. Well, good. Thank you for that explanation. Now, I love this truck. We've seen the film. For those who've seen the film know exactly what I'm talking about. But we have this, I guess, this pride-friendly lettering. It says FX, you know, the name of the film. It's the name of his company. So there you go. So not only is it the name of the film, it's the name of the company that he works for. It'd be like Industrial Light and Magic. They'd have their own van and he'd drive around and they have ILM on the side of the van. Do they do that? So this guy, he seems to live in, I guess it's not a bad looking apartment. It's not that small. It's probably downtown. It's probably pretty pricey. Like, how successful is he?
He's pretty successful. He doesn't live an extravagant life. I mean, it seems like his work is really what sort of keeps him busy and what drives him.
Okay, that's fair. Now, I love the lettering there. And it says here, special effects for television and theater. So what did he do here with that blonde-haired lady in the hotel lobby? I'm confused. He tied her legs up and took the briefcase from her when she was napping in the lobby. Did you see that?
That was his assistant that's driving the truck right now.
Yeah, but what was the purpose of that in the lobby?
When she wakes up to get up, she'll trip.
Is this a joke? It's just like...
yeah, there's never any payoff for it.
Well, okay, so it was a practical joke because she's about to practical joke him back. So I guess that's something they do with each other, maybe.
It
shows their working relationship, I guess. Okay. But there's no payoff, so it was kind of confused. I thought he was stealing something from her.
And
the hotel concierge, whatever, is watching, and he doesn't do anything. Like, yeah, I've got a guy tying a woman up in the lobby, but I'll just let her go.
She could wake up, stand up, and, like, seriously really hurt herself.
Right, yeah, she smashed her head on a coffee table or something, for sure. But I guess she got out of okay, and she's about to get him back.
What's this? You don't smash a guy.
Raleigh, please don't. It's personal.
Come on, Andy, I've known you for 4 years. What is it?
Just don't look in there, okay?
So he gets sprayed with some sort of white powder. I assume it's like baking soda or something, but it could be anthrax for all we know.
Could be, yeah. The movie could have went in a very dark direction.
Yeah. Now we're starting to see a little bit of their, you know, the good friends, the banter. But we're also starting to see a little bit of how clever they can be about some of their devices. And these things will come later in the film, how they can work together in a pinch. Okay, so he agrees to take on the job. So Raleigh says, yeah, I'll do it. I'll take on the job. Lipton is now... who's played by Cliff DeYoung, by the way. Cliff DeYoung is an interesting actor. He's somebody that when you see him, you're like, oh, yeah, I've seen that guy. Biggest role, quite frankly, was Glory in 1990. with Matthew Broderick, Denzel Washington, and Morgan Freeman. Do you ever see that film?
If I have, it's been years. It's been years. Oh, he was also a rock singer, too.
In real life?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, interesting. Anyways, he's one of those faces. He always plays kind of a creep, kind of a bad person. Look, people, they tap into kind of how they're cast. It's how they get work, right? You're like, look, I'm never going to win an Oscar, but I'm a working actor. He's just one of those working actors, and he always seems to play like a creep. He does so in Glory as well, and he does so here. He plays a guy who just kind of turns bad. Here's a sequence that's coming up where Lipton is now going back to Raleigh's apartment again. Right, and of course, he's going to be greeted by the creature again, which he's distracted by. But behind Rowley when he walks through the door behind Limpton when he walks through the door is Rowley, and Raleigh's going to point a gun at a member of the Justice Department. That's a very risky demonstration of.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. Real quick, Cliff DeYoung was a member of a band called Clearlight in the late '60s. They were a psychedelic rock band that opened for the likes of The Doors, Janis Joplin, and Jimi Hendrix.
Oh wow, look at them rubbing shoulders with some legends. That's all. I might piece in some of the music from the band. What are they called again?
Clearlight.
Clearlight. Okay. Was he the singer or?
Yeah.
That's hilarious. Okay, Lipton walks into the apartment, sees the creature, and kind of like, poo-poos it or whatever.
Tyler?
Did anyone see you come up?
Lipton, first name is Tyler. So Raleigh goes, Tyler, did anyone see you come up? And he's already got a gun pointed at his head. Now think about this for a second. If you point a weapon, Craig, at a law enforcement person of any degree, what do you think would happen here in real life?
I think this illustrates sort of how naive Tyler is. He's just a creative. I don't want to say an innocent, kind of like naive creative type. And he doesn't really think through a lot of his actions. And I think that's what leads to him getting into the situation he gets into. He's illustrating his point. He's basically showing Lipton, this is how we're going to do it.
He's basically showing them how squibs work. What he's going to do is Raleigh's going to shoot DeFranco at an Italian restaurant while he's eating. And in order for it to make it look real for the people that are there eating as well, who will be witnesses to this crime, they'll say, yes, the man pointed a weapon at DeFranco, fired five times, you know, two in the head or two in the gut or whatever. And the timing was perfect. You know, granted, I don't think anyone in real life would be like, I don't know, those timings of those weapons and gunshot wounds were off. So I don't know, sir, you might want to check the pulse of this guy. So he's now going to demonstrate the squibs with his alien creature at the door, but Lipton has no idea. You think you could just call them and say, look, I'm going to show you how it's done. This is another situation where it's playing to the audience, too. We don't know, as the movie audience watching this film, what this guy is going to do here. We're in Lipton's shoes, so to speak. We're watching this event play out as you would if you were in Lipton's shoes. But it doesn't really make sense in real life. You just don't point weapons at law enforcement people, ever. That's my recommendation. But here we go. Here's how it plays out.
Hey.
Come on, Lipton. Anyone see you?
No. Come on. What the hell are you doing?
So no one knows you're here?
No. No, my secretary. I told my secretary.
You're lying, Lipton.
Jeez, all right, I'm lying.
For audio listeners, he fired one blank round above Lipton's head. Still, Lipton doesn't know if this weapon's real or not. That's a real gun firing a real sound effect of a gun being fired. He just falls to the ground.
Did he shoot it above his head?
Yes, he pointed it at him. Then he slowly pointed it at the creature. Lipton falls to the ground with the weapon now being moved to the creature to shoot it at this bodyguard creature effect at the front of his door. Now the squibs go off because he's controlling the squib action with his weapon firing at the creature. Lipton has drawn his weapon, though. If you think about it, he's still not sure if that's a real gun or not. In theory, he would be within his right at this point to still shoot.
Then they wouldn't have their patsy.
True. He now sees that he's shooting, quote-unquote, shooting the alien creature. But now Lipton's clued in, okay. But he still points the weapon at Raleigh, and I don't blame him.
You got a dangerous sense of humor, mate.
But I do like how he addresses it. Like, at least he says, hey, what are you doing? Are you insane? You got a dangerous sense of humor. That's a very well-said point there.
So how does this work?
So he just goes on to explain how it works. Essentially, it's just he has a remote control. He's able to control the squibs when they go off that will be in sync with the firing of the weapon.
Yeah, he said it doesn't matter where you shoot. It'll be a bullseye every time.
Yeah, that's a great line.
Basically, now he goes right into the 10-minute or so window where we show him preparing for the job, then the job itself. They have this whole thing where they take all the photos of DeFranco, played by the legendary Jerry Orbach, and they do like the plaster, you know, of his head so they can make the prosthetic so they can do the face shot. And this is all kind of obvious to us nowadays, but 86, this was probably like lifting the curtain for a lot of people.
I totally agree that this is a movie within a movie where we have how they do things in film on the film, showing the audience. Like I said, in 1986, you're right, probably, you know, before YouTube, of course, and all the behind the scene documentary things we see in films, a lot of the stuff was probably foreign to the average moviegoer at the time. How they make the plasters, the makeup, the eyeballs, all that stuff is really cool. So to see the actor, Jerry Orbach, in the film playing the character DeFranco, getting a face plaster mold made for his face. This is how they did it. Actors have, you know, of course, have since expressed how uncomfortable it is. They literally will put straws in your nose to breathe. Yeah. Kind of cool to see it. There's a point where you know it's not Jerry anymore. I think it's there. Or it's probably a stunt double or somebody else sitting in the seat.
They really did do it, though, because on the Blu-ray in the making of, they actually show them making this scene, or they show them making the actual mold.
They have one of Jerry himself, yes, so they would have to have his.
In the making of on the Blu-ray, they show the real special effects team showing Brian Brown how to do it so he would look authentic when he does it here.
When he takes off that mask or that
cap. Yeah, so it's kind of cool. Like, you see them teaching Brian Brown how to be like an FX guy. There's the prosthetics that are going to be squibbed up.
At first, I didn't understand why they put it on his face, but when we get to the quote unquote murder scene, he gets shot in the face. So he'd actually have little squibs of blood go off on his face to make it look like he was shot in the head as well.
Yeah, and that also allows them, because remember, who identifies the body in the morgue? Lipton.
Right.
Then says, yeah, that's DeFranco. He signs the paperwork and that's it. Then he even says it later, like, they got body from somewhere. Here's a scene that completely justifies to me everything that happens to Mason at the end of this movie.
Oh, what part?
I mean, they're on the bridge here, and I mean, Mason just straight up lies to him. As I give you my word, you're protected. He basically says, we want you to do the shot. We don't trust anybody else to do it. He's just straight up lying to him. And this is the moment where he actively decides to ruin Rolly Tyler's life. For me, that justifies everything that happens to him at the end of the movie.
$30,000. 60 seconds work.
Again, great shot there. You see all the way down that avenue.
Michael Corleone went to Sicily. What happens to me?
You are 100% protected. I give you my word.
This voice.
I also give you my thanks. I can't tell you how much we appreciate this.
Yeah, I love the mention to The Godfather. Funny, The Godfather came out 14 years previous to this film.
And he was filming I Dismember Mama.
Yeah. Yeah, 1972. Sorry, both films. Hey, wow. Both are 1972 films. One has gone on to consider to be the greatest film of all time, and the other one is The Godfather. So, yeah, I do like these films where you see that piece of history, especially great cities like New York, because it's just caught on film. And as we get older, as you and I get older, it's really kind of cool to see the old days, you know, that's what we are to us now. This is 36 years ago. To me, that's just crazy. You and I are getting to the age that the movies that we don't consider old are actually old.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But you're right about Mason's voice. Played by an actor, I think his last name is
Mason Adams.
Yeah, is that weird?
They just flip-flopped it. They're like, oh, your first name's Mason? Now your last name's Mason. Colonel Mason, right?
Yes, right. All right, so now we're getting to the scene where, of course, DeFranco's going to get killed.
We had another key plot point here where we learn that DeFranco has a pacemaker.
Right. Yeah, that plays later. Again, we're seeing how they do this. It looks like a piece of body armor or something that you put on an actor. I assume, are they quite that full now? I mean, I thought they were a little bit smaller.
Nowadays, they're probably not even doing squibs in most movies. You're getting, like, the bullshit CGI. Expendables 2 squib
hits.
How
dare you? How dare you? Even Rambo, the fourth Rambo film, Rambo, it has CGI shots, and it's like, oh, come on. There's something really cool about the squib shot, which I don't like that they've taken away. Maybe for safety reasons, I get it.
It's 100% for safety reasons. You know, we had that tragedy a couple of months ago where on that Alec Baldwin movie where the cinematographer was killed. It's just a shame that standards have been lowered so much. The people that can really do this kind of stuff just aren't able to do it anymore.
Yeah.
In the case of the Alec Baldwin movie, there was incompetence on many, many different levels. But back in 86, when they were filming this movie, these guys were the pinnacle of their craft. It was true artistry going on. It's kind of sad. It's like a lost art. You notice that kind of shit. We've talked about, you know, CG before, and, you know, the fact that the Fast and the Furious, when you see a car doing something ridiculous, your mind knows it's a car in a computer simulation, or a computer graphic. Whereas if you watch like Tarantino's Death Proof, those are cars doing real car shit. Or even in this movie later, when we have the big van chase, that's all real. There's no, you know, there's real people driving those vehicles.
Yeah, I agree, but that car chase is pretty cool. You know who he does look like, though? The actor Brian Brown? I figured out. He looks like a Hugh Jackman to Wayne Gretzky had a baby. He seriously does. He's put on the disguise. I love how, again, Raleigh is supposed to do the special effects, but they're making him do the acting. Now, there's no indication that he ever acted this stuff out, so it's kind of interesting they're making him do the acting. But I guess for $30,000 work?
Yeah, they need a patsy.
Right.
For some reason, they felt like they needed to screw somebody over. They basically say no loose ends. So I guess their plan was Raleigh helps fake the murder of DeFranco, and then they kill Raleigh so there's no loose ends. Everything unravels when Raleigh escapes, and at that point they have to sort of set him up. I guess if their plan went 100% to plan, DeFranco is fake murdered, Raleigh is disposed of, and they go off to Geneva and get their $15 million.
Nice little sequence here of the actual shooting.
A shot is great. Oh.
DeFranco comes out with squibs blowing up behind him in his face. And there's a part of me now. I thought he did kill him here. Yeah. That he killed, the character killed DeFranco for real. That the Justice Department. I didn't catch on to the money thing until the very end. You know, when you sometimes first see a film, I don't know why, but I thought they wanted him dead, yes. And so when Lipton turns around in the car to kill Raleigh, I wasn't surprised by that. But at this point, I still thought that DeFranco was dead until he was revealed later.
We also do get that quick scene where he's rigging DeFranco up that he catches Lipton playing with his gun. So that adds that extra little element of doubt that Lipton might have swapped everything out for real bullets. Now, this is a scene, this is probably the hardest scene to swallow in the whole movie for me, because there we're going to see the Rambo First Blood Part 2 poster.
Oh, wait, where is it? I missed it.
It's coming up. You're going to see it when the bum gets up. So as we're waiting for that, the getaway car is waiting for Raleigh. He gets in the back seat. There's Rambo First Blood Part 2.
I didn't even see it. Isn't that crazy? It's just there as clear as day. All right.
Stallone references in this movie. And Raleigh asks why there's plastic in the back seat. And then Lipton, who we have to assume has some level of competency, turns around, holds the gun, a foot away from Raleigh's face?
Right.
And says, sorry, Raleigh, no loose ends.
You should have just shot him without any discussion.
And it allows Raleigh that quick minute where he's able to grab the gun, the driver of the car gets shot, and ultimately Raleigh escapes.
You're right. That's a plot point that I thought of exactly. In real life, had this been like a legit, we need a no loose ends, hop in the car. The moment he hops in the car, you just literally, hey, good job, and blow him away.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have to, hey, just want to say good job, boom. If you turn around with a gun in your hand, no one has time to react.
What if there had just been, like, the gun got jammed or something?
There you go.
And that gave Raleigh the minute to react. But, I mean, if we're really nitpicking the movie, that's, like, one for me that it's probably the only one that's kind of unforgivable. But at this point, the movie's about to get into high gear and never really leave. So at this point, Raleigh thinks that Lipton sort of has gone rogue. He's off the reservation.
I don't know if we're allowed to say that.
No, I guess we're not. I'm canceled.
We can't cancel something that never existed. It's okay. Nobody listens to our show anyway, so we can't be canceled.
He calls Mason, and Mason does a tremendous acting job here, where he acts like Lipton is acting completely on his own, and he insinuates that Lipton and DeFranco are in cahoots, and he asks Raleigh where he is, and says, stay there. And then this is another, this happens in movies all the time. Poor innocent bystanders get massacred for no reason.
Yeah, so he's talking on a payphone. And I miss those old days of the payphone. Remember the old days of the payphone? You have a phone call, and think of all the germs on those phones. Ugh.
Oh, yeah, my goodness.
Oh, everyone's mouse on there. But anyways, we didn't really think of it back in the day, but you got these public payphones, and the old, somebody knocking on that thing behind you on the door, like, are you going to be how much longer are you going to be here, you know? And
yeah.
So it's my turn to talk on the phone. So somebody, you know, knocks, hey, I'd like to use the phone, please. And
sounds like he's setting up some cool plans, too. He's calling his girl. It sounds like he's, hey, you know, Trish and Steve want to go out. Who cares that it's raining?
Yeah. Yeah. He's, well, he is a very positive person. He's, hey, the rain don't bother me, none.
Well, he's about to die in a rain of bullets.
Oh, nice. So yeah, he gets killed. And then, of course, now Riley realizes they thought that was me in the booth. I'm supposed to be a dead man.
One of the two hitmen there, we see him later in the movie, is Tom Noonan, who went on to quite a career, including played the first Hannibal Lecter movie, Manhunter. He was the killer in that movie.
Oh, nice. Yeah, Manhunter. I haven't seen that one in a while. Now, check out this cadaver here. So they've got DeFranco, and this cop who's not corrupt says, is that him? Yeah, that's him.
Now, it's Gordon from Sesame Street, right?
That's right. I was wondering where he was from. That is... that's right! My brain was like, where have I seen him before? Of course.
It's fucking Gordon from Sesame Street.
Oh, wow.
This brings up an interesting question, Ryan. Not only did they find a cadaver, they found a cadaver that had fresh wounds.
Oh, I see why they had him shot in the face. They wanted to make it so he was so disfigured that it was hard to identify. And so when the Justice Department comes in and says, yeah, that is DeFranco, despite the tragic face destruction, that's him. Now that makes more sense why he had the face damage. It was to make him unrecognizable.
Yeah. So but wouldn't they have needed a fresh cadaver, too? Because if you shoot a dead person...
Oh, they killed somebody recently. I don't know who it was, but they could have killed that bum in the box, for all we know.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, because, you know, I mean, the blood stains on the sheet indicate... the body bled when it was shot. You shoot a cadaver, and there's no blood coming out.
Now Riley knows that he's on the run. He's on the run from the Justice Department. He still gets a quick lay-in with his girlfriend, though, before...
Yeah, and his girlfriend actually gives some good advice. This is the next morning, of course. She basically says, hey, go to the press. Get in front of this. And he says, well, why would they believe me? And she says, I believe you. You know...
Gordon Bernstein. Blow the whistle on these bastards.
Blow the whistle.
What makes you think they believe me?
I believe you. Stop being so paranoid.
Bill Conti set it up, man. He set it up with that beautiful music cue.
Such a gorgeous girl.
Such a gorgeous girl, about to get her head blown off.
Oh, man, this is... And this guy, how long do you think this guy was going to beat on that window waiting for the curtain to open?
Were you?
I can't remember at this point.
I didn't think she was going to get killed here. I was not expecting it. Maybe with that kind of shot, but... Right there. And she gets shot. Now, I was overthinking this because I've seen too many Christopher Nolan films. I thought she was faking her death. He never quite looks at her very well to see if she's truly dead. I thought she was using special effects on her body.
Oh, like you thought she was part of the conspiracy?
Yes.
I guess the filmmakers did their job then. I mean, they kept you guessing.
I was overthinking, but there's a part of me is like, oh, who's in on this? Is she in? Because we've seen all those movies where the girlfriend's in on it too. Like a movie like The Game, David Fincher's The Game. Like, who's the players or who's bystanders, right? In this film, it's just him. He's the only one being played.
Here's another case of the front door just being unlocked.
Well, that's what I didn't understand. I thought it looks locked there, but he's somehow able, the guy coming in, he's able to open it. So he probably just has like some
skeleton key.
Yeah, because he...
And then Brian Brown is able to hide behind all these boxes that he climbed up here and then reset all the boxes.
I thought the same thing. So he's up high on their shelving unit, knowing that someone's coming to kill him. This is the guy that killed the girlfriend. So now he's ran across the street because he shot from the building, ran down the building, ran across the street to the house now to finish off Raleigh. And then, he's able to... Oh, actually, I have a theory. Those boxes were up. He was able to climb behind them.
Yeah, behind him, yeah. This is an awesome fight scene, and this is a fight scene that I've loved ever since the first time I saw the movie when I was 12 years old. Mandel talks about it in the interview on the Blu-ray. He says that Terry Rawlings, the Academy Award winning, not for this film, but editor, cut this scene together early on. So this was a scene they shot early, and Terry Rawlings cut it together brilliantly, and sent it off to the studio without the director knowing this. This fight scene here convinced the studio to give them more money that allowed them to do that complete car chase that we see later in the film.
Oh, wow.
So they were originally going to do a very, very scaled down version of that car chase, and the studio, seeing this scene cut together as it was, said, wow, this movie, it's got some potential.
Turns like violent really quickly here. He uses everything, literally the whole kitchen, appliances, kettles, the iron that's there will be used later, pots and pans. And you got that fire burning on the stove still. They were making tea. It looks like Brian Brown is doing a lot of his own stunts when he's being thrown on the counter there, backwards on the counter. That's Brian Brown. And the guy that he's fighting, the killer he's fighting,
hits you.
Now look, he beats him to a pulp with the iron. Like, that's brutal.
Yeah.
What I love about that is, like, this character in the film, obviously the character, he's now fully invested to the fact that I'm on the run for my life. He starts killing people. It's Rambo meets George Lucas meets Home Alone.
He just saw his girlfriend murdered, and he was set up by the Justice Department. So at this point, he's reacting like a cornered animal will. And then here we go, 40-some-odd minutes into the film, we get the introduction of Brian Dennehy.
Died. I love it. It got the ice cream with the fries and takeout Chinese food and peanuts. Like, this explains my physique, says Brian Dennehy.
And what a sad bed that is, though, too, man. I noticed, like, everybody in this movie, they don't have good beds. Brian Brown's girlfriend didn't have a great bed. Dennehy's bed frame here looks very, very inadequate for a man of Dennehy's size. Looks like a kid's bed.
Now, this guy here, Trey Wilson, he's the one playing Lieutenant Murdoch here. Or Lieutenant Murdoch, sorry, I did the Canadian lieutenant. Lieutenant Murdoch.
Great.
He's dead.
In real life?
Yeah, he died. He died at the age of 40. So he's younger than 40 here. I don't know. What is it? Yes.
Oh.
Yes, he's 37 here. He died in 89 at the age of 40.
I don't believe that.
Yeah.
Well, Patrick, is it Patrick Stack?
No, Patrick Stack was the actor that was in First Blood.
Well, he's in this movie.
Yeah, he is. He's later. He played Lieutenant Morgan.
So there's four Stallone connections.
Oh, I thought that was the third one. I thought that was the obvious one. The moment he came on screen, because we talked about that before, I saw it. So when that came on, I was like, that's Lieutenant Morgan and Will Teasel reversing their roles now, because from First Blood, from that sequence in First Blood after the bazooka shot into the mine, they're working together again 4 years later in this film.
For those keeping score at home, we've got the Bill Conti score.
Yeah.
We've got the Brian Dennehy appearance.
Two.
We've got the Rambo First Blood Part 2 poster. And then we've got this guy from First Blood.
First Blood, he'll come in later. Yeah, at the end of the film.
Yeah.
Four Stallone. Hey, man. It's part of the last of the Action Hero Podcast Network and Stallone podcasts combining. Absolutely. Stallone's everywhere. But yeah, this actor here is 37 right now in this film.
His name is Joe Gafassi.
No, Trey Wilson played Lieutenant Murdoch.
I think you're mistaken. This is Joe Gafassi. He's still alive.
Is he playing the character Mickey there? This guy right here behind Dennehy, that's his buddy. That's his lieutenant. That's another cop. I'm looking at his picture, too, here on IMDb.
And according to IMDb, he's still alive.
Trey Wilson?
It's Joe Gafassi.
We'll have to look up Trey Wilson in the film. He plays Lieutenant Murdoch.
I'm going
to
give you the name that he has in this movie. Joe Gafassi plays Mickey.
Okay.
And he was 42 in this movie.
Either way, Trey Wilson's dead. Whoever the hell he is. Let's go back to Dennehy. So we got Dennehy now. He is 40. We know that. Dennehy's alive. Well, he's dead too now, but he was alive and well in this film. Okay. This, now we're getting to the scene here where Dennehy will go to the, I love the old computers back in the day. This, lady's bringing up information on the internet about who was at the crime scene. So they got the name Williams. That was the guy that was playing the attacker slash murderer of the girlfriend and the one that he killed with the iron. Rolly killed with the iron. Anyway, so his name is Williams. He did some time in the police force, some time in the army.
By the way, as a kid, this movie came out, we were living, my family, we're living in a town called Pittsfield, Massachusetts. If you look at the computer readout here, it shows that this dude was born in Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
Oh, wow.
So that was an Easter egg for us every time we watched this movie.
Oh, nice.
Because Pittsfield is just a random town in rural Massachusetts.
A Slycast connection. There you go.
Somebody decided to use Pittsfield. We always got a kick out of that.
So this actress here, her name is Lopez. In the film, I don't remember her name in real life. If we were a better
podcast. She dead too?
No. Well, no. She's not dead. A lot of these actors are dead. Trey Wilson's
great.
Dead. But she was good. This film and FX2 are the only two films she's ever been in.
That's a perfect filmography, in my opinion.
Her name is Marissa Velez in the film, and she's played by Jossie de Guzman, but she does Broadway and off-Broadway, so that's your connection with the director. So they probably work together off-screen. Say, hey, you want to come pop in on a film? But she does a great job acting here, and it's just weird how she never yeah. caught the, because I'm sure she would have gotten other roles, but I guarantee you it was a decision she made.
Like living and working in Manhattan and didn't want to go to Hollywood. One thing I've always loved about this movie is the relationship between Dennehy and this woman. You know, it's kind of flirty. He knows that Dennehy uses her for information, but he takes care of her. He buys her plane tickets. I just love it. I love their interactions, and I think it helps this movie stand out a little bit.
Agreed. Though, he gives her a big kiss when she gives him information. I don't think that's allowed. Even if somebody, even if somebody does something nice for you, you don't get to quote Will Teasel in the Rambo film First Blood. You don't get to give her a big sloppy kiss.
There's Pittsfield, by the way.
So watch here. He's so happy with the news. See, that's Murdoch. I'm telling you right now. No, that's
it's not.
Yes, it is.
Bales Prince, yeah. Match your dead cop, Adams.
I wonder if he'll say his name. Let's just wait.
Leo.
Hey, Mickey. How'd you make out with
Oh, Mickey.
Name?
You're right. That's Mick. Okay, who's Lieutenant Murdoch?
Well, I don't know.
Okay, well, Lieutenant Murdoch, who was played by Trey Wilson, he's dead. But anyways.
This guy is very much still alive. Look up his IMDb picture.
Yeah, I see. He's older. Yeah. Fair enough. So you're right. But still, Trey Wilson's still dead. But I just want to see who he is in the film now. But anyways, here's the kiss. Watch this.
Leo, the file's closed.
Reopen.
I think it's the next scene. They have two scenes together. Okay. I think it's the second scene they have together. He gives her a big sloppy kiss. I'm like, you know how much trouble you get in if you did that to a coworker right now?
Mm.
I wouldn't recommend it.
See, now this is where Mason and Lipton are getting chewed out by somebody, for, I guess, on the police end of things.
Maybe that's Lieutenant Murdoch.
Maybe.
And he's 37 here.
What can I say? You want my...
Here's a little dog and pony show going on.
My desk, 1 hour.
Right.
Look, I'll get out of your hair.
Thanks, Murdoch.
Yes, Murdoch.
I want you to meet Agent Whitmore.
Agent Whitmore will be liaison with your office.
Anything I can do.
Why does he look like he's 55?
Oh. 1 hour.
So you're right about. So what we heard in the background there as we're talking over is you got Mason and Lipton pretending he's getting fired. He's in trouble. But yeah, it's a dog and pony show for sure.
You bought that? Maybe.
Lieutenant Murdoch. Is it true?
Now, see if you can spot Angela Bassett here. Do you see her?
Yeah, it's her. This is her first movie.
It's her right. He's here.
Yep, she's the reporter. Yep,
there she is. I mean, obviously, you'd have to watch this on YouTube if you're watching this. But there's Angela Bassett, her first movie appearance, just yelling. That's her in the background. I love how she's being credited, but that's it. That's the only scene we see of her. But there's her first appearance in film. She looks the same now. She has aged amazing.
We basically get Dennehy. You know, we get a little bit more motivation here. Dennehy says, "Hey, I don't care about getting credit for it. Give this case to me. Give me DeFranco. I'll take care of it. I'll clean up your mess."
That's where I got confused. So he's talking to Murdoch, dead Murdoch here.
Yeah.
Franco's killer. Why don't you just give it up, Leo?
Yeah, so he's told to give it up, stop chasing this. Well, we know Will Teasel does not give up the chase.
There's Gordon from Sesame Street.
It is him. I double checked. That is him. I wanted to make sure. Yeah. That's Gordon. That's great. Good for him to do this adult film. He probably got so tired of working with Muppets and puppets. He's like, I'm gonna do an adult show here.
Yeah, I'm sure if Doug was here, he would probably not agree with us or agree with me. But another thing I liked about this movie is you see like some semblance of police work going on. You actually see Brian Dennehy investigating and doing quote unquote detective work. Now, how accurate it is, I have no idea, but as a moviegoer, I'm sold on it. It shows him connecting the dots and figuring things out, even though he doesn't know the ultimate why, but he's figuring out how Tyler's involved, and he basically figures out enough to wind up at Mason's at the end of the movie.
So now we got a sequence here of his assistant, which I forget her name, but...
Yeah, she's from The Legend of Billie Jean, and there's Tom Noonan from Manhunter.
Yes, you know who he looks like? And I actually had to double check, so there's no way. He looks like that bald-headed actor from 30 Rock with Tina Fey.
Yeah, he's taller.
But he's taller, but doesn't his face look like... It's like they're doppelgangers.
Yeah, but this is cool. It's Central Park. Again, this is not something I think... I mean, this is New York on film. I mean, nowadays it costs so much to film in New York that people just don't bother. In fact, the sequel of this movie they filmed in Canada with a couple of establishing shots that they shot in Manhattan.
So what happened here, folks that are listening on iTunes, of course, is that this guy, I guess he's hired by the State Department or whatever to track down them or to essentially kill them. Like we're allegedly
He's one of the two guys that were in that drive-by at the Mason's got, in addition to Lipton, he had three guys working for him. The dude that from Pittsfield that died at the girlfriend's apartment, Raleigh ironed to death, and then the two guys that did the hit at the phone booth.
Okay.
This is one of the two guys that did the phone booth hit.
Okay, so he was there, I guess, to off them or whatever, and Raleigh pushes the bad guy into the water, which I thought was just kind of funny. Like, wouldn't it have just been easier just to not push him into the water, just escape to the back of the store or something and just run away? Like, it's just kind of a funny... He kind of exposed where he was by exposing where he was. He wasn't spotted then. He could have just kept...
I love how cops are tricked by the noises from this this alien animatronic. Did they think there's like a wild animal in that apartment?
It works. Hey, that's why Raleigh set it up. It tricks the burglars and the cops alike, this creature.
But the cops are like, let us in. It's just such a weird noise that you'd think that I don't know what they were expecting to find on the other side of that door. Here's a little bit of police work going on.
Yeah, they go through. They say, well, we're here now. What they said, too, I believe, is like, well, since we're here, this is Mickey, of course, Mickey and Leo, played by Dennehy. Since we're here, we might as well see if there's anything that we get a warrant for. So they're almost kind of cheating. Let's see if we can find something, then we'll get a warrant to search.
And then this is where the dummy comes into play, because Leo notices that the bullet patterns on the dummy or the animatronic monster match up with wounds that DeFranco had.
Doesn't it look like the creature from the Star Wars film Empire Strikes
Back? It looks like a Wampa. Yeah, it definitely looks kind of like a Wampa. That's not a Wampa. What was the Hoth monster?
I don't know the name of the creature, but
the Wampa was the thing that Luke rides. That was a Wampa. What was the Hoth monster's name, though? Would have known this 10 years ago.
So now we've gotten to the part in the film where Raleigh looks like the character from Harry Potter films.
It is a Wampa.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yeah.
And now Dennehy is back in the with Velez to get more information about the people that they're chasing.
I think this is where the kiss is.
This is where the kiss is. I just want to show you that. He's so excited about the information.
You fucking rat!
Right on the lips.
Come home to Jamaica and have a hell of a time. Thanks a lot, Velez.
Have fun in Jamaica.
Please.
Can you imagine? I'm sorry, if I had done that to any of my coworkers or something like that, can you imagine the crap show you'd be in as a coworker? Oh, man. Big sloppy kiss, unasked for.
Colonel Mason, these men have been waiting for you.
So now they've gone to talk to Mason. He's a suspect as far as Leo's concerned, or a loose end. He wants to know, hey, what's going on here? Anything you want to say?
They found out that the dude from Pittsfield that Raleigh killed worked for Mason.
That's right.
At some point.
He was found murdered this
morning. And Mason, I think, kind of fucks up a little bit here, because Mason does like the, oh, I've never heard of this guy. Yeah. And then he kind of finds a workaround. He's like, yeah, the reason I don't know who this guy is because he's a floater. You know, he's a guy that we used for particular missions, if you will. And he hasn't been on our books officially in like 3 years. Sure. He kind of works his way out of it.
A little bit, but Leo's like, I'm not convinced. See, there's too many loose... He explains them to Mickey here.
Everybody, Mickey, everybody has a morbid sense of curiosity.
Of course.
Everybody except for Adam's old boss.
It's a theory.
He died.
Mason is definitely bent.
So he's saying that Mason didn't ask about the murder, how he got murdered.
Yeah.
You know, everyone wants to know that, especially, you know, his boss. Like, how did he get murdered? Do we have any suspects? Like, he didn't do any follow-up questions, and that struck Leo as odd that this guy...
Because he knew.
Yeah, well, because he knew the answers, exactly.
Again, you know, you're just getting some of that great police work. Here's a great action beat where Raleigh calls Mason's office, does the classic two phones hooked up together. It looks like he's calling from the lobby of the building. And this is just Raleigh setting up Lipton to be able to get access to Lipton. He tells Lipton, meet me at this place in 20 minutes. He has no intention of doing that because he's going to be in the back seat of the car.
Tim from our Discord says, yeah, they ride tauntauns, and it was called the Wampa that knocked out Luke's
okay.
There you go.
Well, tauntaun, yeah. I thought they smelled bad on the outside.
Welcome to our Star Wars podcast. Hey, you know what the internet needs? Another Star Wars podcast.
Yeah, right? So this is great. You know, we get you know, Raleigh, Lipton. He puts like that, what is it, like a garrote, I think they call it.
Yeah, it's a really thin wire. They use them in mafia movie films all the time where they strangle the poor driver with this, almost like piano wire. There's a sequence that comes up later when he takes the wire, the string off his neck. You can actually see on the actor's neck a line.
It's like a mark, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't, obviously, could it just be makeup or did it leave a mark on his neck? Either way, it's...
Yeah, that might have ended his singing career, too.
Oh, yeah, good point.
We got another scene with...
I thought it was just two. Oh. I guess there's three scenes between Velez.
I think you... Did you rewind it?
No. He kisses her hand.
Oh, like, no, this is where they figure out that the three guys have consecutive Social Security numbers.
Let's hear his reaction.
Even though they were born in different years in different states.
Yeah. Thanks. Take all of Jamaica and the Bronx and Staten Island, too.
He said that to Velez. Is she kind of hot for him too, or?
I think so. Yeah, I think there's. I definitely think they've done it.
Oh, you think so?
I think so. Yeah.
Because now we're in the sequence here of Rolly with Lipton in the car strangling him. Look at his neck. See, look at the line there. Watch.
Yeah. Uh huh.
He moves his hand. There's a line there where the string was. So either it was really leaving an imprint on his skin, or they did a makeup job there. So he's kidnapped Lipton. Now, why was she in the back trunk? Just to hide from Linton, or?
Because he's still going to need her. He needs her help get his van back. So they wanted to deal with Lipton first. So he's got like a checklist, Raleigh. And on the checklist was like, get Lipton, get my van. So he needs her help to get the van. That's why he gets her involved. And then he gets her uninvolved very quickly, which I really like because it would have been irresponsible to keep her involved. But this is a really cool, unique sort of interrogation scene. I don't think we've ever seen a scene like this before where he puts the guy in the trunk. He's like, tell us what we want. And if not, I'm just going to keep backing this car into other cars, into pylons, into
he
concrete abutments.
He smashes it to the side of the bridge, the bridge pillar.
Boom, right there.
So Lipton's in the trunk being jostled and finally gives up the address of where. So what he's asking for the address of Mason. Where is Mason hiding out? So his purpose to go to Mason at his mansion is what exactly?
Well, he knows that DeFranco's there. I don't think Tyler has anything on his mind other than vengeance. He wants to make Mason and DeFranco pay for the death of his girlfriend. I really think that's it. He doesn't know about any kind of money. He just knows that these guys set him up, and they set up the wrong guy, and he can use his particular set of skills to get his revenge.
He gets to the mansion, and he disposes of people and kills people. Like, he's already got one. Like, I'm not saying he's a murderer, but I'm saying he killed that hitman who was, you know. But I'm surprised at that point he didn't just call the police saying, look, this guy invaded my home and tried to kill me. Wouldn't that have been helpful? Like, why was he on the run from just the normal police? Did he think everyone was corrupt?
He didn't know who he could trust. So, and this is where Dennehy does his police work. He calls Mason's house, and of course, DeFranco loses his shit and reveals that he's alive, and all the pieces are now connected for Leo. He's done all his police work, and he sort of has the missing piece of this puzzle.
No, DeFranco's alive. Mason's hiding him. He's at the mansion. He's at Mason's mansion, just like I thought. And concurrently, Raleigh and his assistant are breaking into the tow truck company impound where his vehicle is. It's the vehicle with the big FX on the side, on the side of the van.
This is a really cool sequence. You know, he basically says, hey, to his assistant, rig up a couple of explosions, and she ends up setting the big ones. He told her to use smaller explosions, but of course she wanted to go big or go home. I think this is a really cool sequence. It just shows, again, like the ingenuity, how he can go about with getting his van back without being followed.
Yeah, so she puts these firework-type gunpowder explosions. They're strong enough to cause explosions underneath the vehicles, almost like lift them off the ground in the parking lot, to cause, I guess, a distraction. So when they go off, I guess there's a police officer working. Is this like a police pound?
This is a police impound, yeah.
Okay. You know, you got a couple of officers there, security guards there. Then you have a couple of civilians coming to get their vehicle for whatever reason, and they're releasing their vehicle to these civilians from the... They're just lucky they didn't put an explosive under it. They could have been, like, murdered two innocent people. They were very close to doing it, too.
The only thing that Tyler didn't account for here is that the actor, who's very much still alive, was staking out the place.
Would you stop it? Look, I got the actor... Murdoch and him look the same, don't they? Murdoch and Mickey look very similar. Let's be fair. So the actor that played Murdoch, he's the one that's dead. Trey Wilson, rest in peace, Trey.
This is where we get the car chase, thanks to Terry Rawlings and his beautiful editing of the fight scene, convinced the studio to give him extra money to do this. And we get a legit car chase through Manhattan, which is pretty neat.
When I thought you were asking for Rocky or Sloan stuff, I thought you were talking about the meat punch.
Yeah, some of that meat, it would have been rotten by that point. So that is not the same meat from any of the Rocky movies.
So, yeah, so what happened there is the car chasing them in the van, the police car, goes through a bunch of hanging meat outside, and it's gross. It leaves this blood. You know how the blood from your meat when you buy it? And for the packages, it's all over his windshield. I found that part kind of gross. I don't know why.
Well, you know what's even grosser is that odds are that that meat was packaged and somebody ate a week later.
Well, I've always said, I wonder who ate the meat that Rocky punched. Somebody ate it. Yeah.
So this is kind of cool. They use more of their Hollywood magic to avoid the cops in this. You know, he's calling out gimmicks they did during certain movies. It sounds like they did like a Cannonball Run type movie. So they put down the oil slick and it culminates with the dummy.
Yeah, so they throw a dummy on the ground. So yeah, the van with the special effects equipment, they're on the run for the cops. Gracie, it's something you have to kind of watch. Go on YouTube. It's probably there. Or come to our channel and watch it. They run over an old lady dummy. So he slams his car to not run over a body on the ground. Then he gets hit from behind from another police car chasing as well. And then it runs over the dummy and they see that it is a dummy. But what I don't understand is why didn't they just move the dummy out of the way and continue the car chase? Their vehicles weren't out of commission. I don't know why they just gave up the chase.
I think at that point there had to be an investigation probably.
Well, maybe. Fair enough. Doug, if he was here, I'm sure he would tell us. I would bet that they could probably get back in their vehicles and continue the chase, since that was just a decoy, like you said.
Had to end at some point.
Yeah, I know. But it was a clever way to end it. I've never seen that. And all the car chases and movies I've seen, I've never seen a car chase end because they tricked them thinking there was a body on the ground. So give them full credit for that. So now he's about to get fired from his job as a police officer.
Some great acting. So we learn that not only is Brian Dennehy a great actor, but Leo is also a pretty good actor as well, because the character Leo. Yeah. Basically, this whole charade he's putting on is so he can steal Gordon's badge.
But why? Okay, so he steals Gordon's badge and gun off his desk. But why? What did that serve at the end of the film?
Doesn't serve anything,
okay.
Really.
Okay, because he never uses it or brings it up.
Well, you know, he does call the one cop to Mason's house at the end.
Yeah, that's Lieutenant Morgan from First Blood he calls. He calls him, who's state police. Like, he knows how to call state police. He calls him in. He didn't show him his badge over the phone. Like, either way, the state police would have come. The call came in all the same.
And this is also where Gordon basically calls Murdoch an asshole. It's always great when the asshole in a movie actually gets acknowledged and called an asshole by somebody else. And I'm sure Gordon loved being able to deliver that line.
Yeah, because he was full on Sesame Street mode in the 80s.
Yeah.
He does a good job kind of consoling Leo's all sad and everything. And
yeah, his career is over, so he is showing some empathy, even though he knows everything Leo did justifies him being fired like this. But still, he, as a fellow human, he feels for the guy.
That's where he stole the badge. Now you watch, he pocks it right there.
Yep.
And the other guy's caught it. See the guy there to his left? That's Trey Wilson, who's dead. Come on, he looks like Mickey. You can see how you get the two mixed up. Come on.
We really get to the climax of the film where this is really the true sort of Rambo meets Home Alone.
Yes.
We get to see Tyler do all of his Hollywood tricks to take out security guys and to infiltrate the house. He electrocutes this guy on the fence.
So what I love is the special effects guy. Like, special effects are one thing, but he's got enough voltage in his van to kill people.
I don't know if he killed that guy or not. You know, it might have just been enough to, like, really ruin that guy's
Franco. Game.
He facilitates it.
Right. Look, at the end of the day, he created the devices that caused the death of somebody. I don't get this one. This balloon comes down to this other guard and blows up. And are we led to believe that he, too, is dead or just...
It's got some kind of... I think like it had a...
flashbang type stuff?
Gas or something inside of it that
burns his face. Look, his face is burnt. Uh-huh. And he grabs his throat and collapses. Yeah. Like, I think he's dead.
Yeah.
I think Raleigh's gone full Rambo. It's just as George Lucas meets Rambo.
Again, all justified in my opinion.
Fair enough. I'm not calling him a murderer. What I'm getting at is he just goes, whatever got triggered in him. Look, those guys on the ground, they're dead. Like, they're not moving. I think we're led to believe they have died. Those are bodies.
He saw his girlfriend taken out by a sniper.
So yeah, he's out for vengeance. It's a revenge film.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
I think that's the only one of my criticisms of the film, actually legit, is you're right about what you're saying, but as a first-time viewer, his lead-up or his turning like Liam Neeson from Taken-type moments here, I kind of wish they pushed into it a little bit more that he's out for revenge. Like, he's doing it, but it's never spoken about to the blonde-haired girl or anyone. I wanted some dialogue saying, these bastards have to pay. They're going to pay. The law can't help me. Nobody's going to believe me. I want to take them out. Because that's what he does.
This facilitates it.
But you get what I'm saying. Because I'm like, is he actually killing them? No, he's killing people. And it is a revenge film at the end of it all. But I kind of wish they...
Yeah.
So he sets up this elaborate mirror scheme in the hallway. So one guy gets shot by the other guy. I wonder if the movie Ghost Protocol Mission Impossible ripped off this.
Oh, yeah. This definitely felt like a Mission Impossible gag to me.
But yeah, but this is 86. Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol came out, 25 years later almost.
Yeah.
But that 30 years later, and they did a great job in that film, but they did the exact same thing, like tricking you and thinking of a false hallway.
It's a Hollywood trick.
Yeah.
Like, that was still in use during Ghost Protocol.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So it's legit. This is how they do it. I found that very interesting. This film, it exposes the tricks.
Now, who gets it worse here? So he sets up the fake hallway so the one guy shoots the other. And then the guy that shoots his partner, he trips on the tripwire and then gets hit in the back of the head with like a little ball peen hammer. Who gets it worse there? Is it the guy that gets shot by his partner or the ball peen hammer to the back of the head? I'm saying the ball peen hammer.
Yeah, let's watch that. Here. Oof. That sequence right there where, so for people who aren't watching, the guy gets shot through the two-way mirror setup. And then the guy who did the shooting, he runs away. He trips in the hallway with the tripwire. And then Raleigh comes out from a doorway from a bedroom and bludgeons him in the head to death. This must have been in his blood already to be this kind of brutal. Like, he's taking people out with hand weapons.
Those are the two guys that shot up the phone booth.
Oh, yeah. That's fair.
So,
and they don't deserve it. I'm saying the character showed no signs that he had this in him to be this culprit.
In Tyler's mind, those are two guys that would have killed him. If he had been in that phone booth, would have killed him. And you know what? They didn't kill Tyler. They killed some poor innocent bystander.
How does this work? How does it work that Raleigh crashes through the window after he's supposedly been shot by DeFranco? So he had to be out of the way, out of the bullets, right? When the firing ends from DeFranco, because he's firing through the wall and glass... Raleigh comes through and says, oh, no, you really got me. Why would he even do that? What's the purpose of doing that fake death moment there? Why wouldn't he just stay hidden? Because the helicopter's coming all the same.
So he wants the police to find him dead. So ultimately, so DeFranco hits the door, he gets electrocuted, his pacemaker betrays him, Mason gets the keys. If you notice, Tyler put some kind of prosthetic on his vital points, so when they check for his pulse, think he's dead. It was an out for Tyler because none of what happens here vindicates Tyler.
That guy with Dennehy, that's Patrick Stack. I did reach out to him for my First Blood podcast. I reached out to him. No response. I mean, look, I'm just saying, come on, Patrick Stack.
Yeah.
Like, come on. Nobody's calling you for podcasts. Let's be honest. Come on. Come on the show. Talk to us about your time with Dennehy on this film and on First Blood. But yeah, that's okay. Maybe he'll get back to me. I always wonder about some, why would you want to just plug yourself a little bit? Anyways. I was hoping that he'd come back. He teaches acting in L.A. is what he does right now.
Okay, different. So here's where Mason doesn't hate the player, doesn't hate the game, realizes he was outsmarted by Tyler. The officer cut Tyler in. He's like, hey, here's $15 million. Here's what the whole movie's about. This is the movie, all the money that DeFranco stole from the mob and was going to go split, I think, ways. I don't think Mason ever thought Lipton was going to be part of the equation. I think Mason is such a dastardly dog that he really thought it was going to be the Mason and DeFranco show, and they each get $7.5 million or whatever. Here's where Tyler completely beautifully plays Mason like a violin. He leaves the gun there, Mason to betray him. Mason isn't smart enough to understand that Tyler is always one step ahead.
At this moment, his hand is crazy glued to the gun.
1,001 uses, now 1,002.
You touch crazy glue, you'll feel it. It's going to act quickly, yes. But the fact that he doesn't react to it at all, You know what I mean? Like,
it's cold steel. It's cold steel, man.
Oh, stop it.
Suicide by cop.
Yes. Now, here's an interesting thing. One of my favorite movies of all time is Young Guns 2, and they do the same thing in Young Guns 2 when they dress that guy up like a Native American, one of the cops, and they throw him out and go, "We're coming out, but we're coming out shooting," and they shoot their own guy. So I wonder if the writer of that film knew about this film, because they use the exact same... Like, that's a pretty cool sequence. I thought I saw it for the first time, Young Guns 2, but that was, you know, 7 years later after this film or whatever.
Yeah.
In this film, they're talking about how special effects are sort of taken away from films and the quality of films, and that it's important that we don't stop telling a good story.
Yeah, and this is 35 years ago.
Yes.
Which is what people complain about today.
But did you find that very kind of telling and ironic that this was a discussion point 35 years ago?
What's even funnier is we talked about Siskel and Ebert earlier. I think I was watching their Best and Worst of 78 episode. They talk about special effects movies, basically whatever the Marvel movies were of the time, and they bemoan the fact that these big budget movies are ultimately going to be the end of cinema as we know it. And that was over 40 years ago. So it is funny how sort of history repeats itself and the sky is always falling,
right?
Never quite gets there.
And now movies are bigger than ever. But I did find that, very telling that when special effects were being used in these 80s films, Back to the Future came out the year before. So things like that. And they're trying to say, hey, if we let special effects dictate the story, they're going to lose the story. But this is that movie within a movie where they're using special effects in a movie about special effects, but they're telling a good story. So they're trying to show you that you can tell a good story with special effects by having a movie about special effects. I don't know. I thought that was very, very meta. What do you think?
No, absolutely. And the director kind of talks about it in his 15-minute interview that's on the Blu-ray. He talks about how he wanted to also showcase like real violence versus Hollywood violence. So I think if you go back and analyze this film and look at the real violence versus the movie violence that we're supposed to be tricked into seeing, there's a difference. And then here's where Leo gets his final justification that all the police work he did leading up to this, he's caught Tyler. Basically, it works out for both of them because they've got access to $15 million and they've also got access to the ability to make themselves look like DeFranco.
Yeah, this threw me off. Again, talk about Mission Impossible. Mission Impossible ripped off this idea about masking up to look like... Didn't they do it the first film? Remember that? That was a big thing in that
film.
Yeah, so here's the sequence here of DeFranco walking out of the bank with the $15 million. I got tricked. Again, as a first-time viewer, I thought, wait, did DeFranco fake his death twice? Because with that heart attack, I thought he faked his heart attack. And I thought, oh my gosh, Dennehy's he's really a bad guy. He got the money. And I thought FX2 would be about Raleigh coming back to get the money from him or something. I don't know.
The bigger question is, where did Tyler get all of the stuff he needed to replicate DeFranco? Because if you remember earlier in the film, Lipton tells him to destroy all of the stuff.
Yes,
you know,
I thought the
plaster
thing.
Cast and the pictures.
He smashed, yes, but I guarantee you he had a second.
Kept the mold.
He kept the mold or had a second one, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so here's Ryan is tricked until this very moment here.
I'm tricked.
And Ryan has the oh my god moment.
Yeah, he pulls off Gary's face.
Ryan says, damn it, you got me again. Now they both got plenty of money to.
So what happens in FX2? Don't tell me, because now as these two characters pull out, off they go. Are they in Switzerland right now?
They're like Geneva.
Geneva or something, because there's a foreign license plate and sticker there. They're living large and they've got $15 million, so I guess
Trey Wilson gets a
credit. There's Trey Wilson co-starring. I told you, he's dead though. I think this is Switzerland because they got the Swiss Alps.
I love this too, Ryan. I want to say I love the fact that, again, they're telling us this was sort of a movie. We're seeing all of the characters, some of them that are dead, looking directly at the camera, smiling. This is sort of like, I guess, behind the scenes footage or, footage
laughing.
Before.
They're all laughing. They're, every one of them has laughed, even Cliff DeYoung here. They're all kind of having fun and being goofy because it's just a movie, guys. It's just a movie. Yeah.
I really, really like that. You get a cool sort of cherry. We're back. I think it's a great ending, and you got that great song Illusion by I think the band's called Imagination.
Yep.
It kind of sounds like DeBarge. So Ryan, I haven't really been able to get a handle. Did you like or love this movie?
Was that not clear?
You seemed very neutral.
Quite enjoyed it. I really did enjoy it. I was never bored. I was surprised about how much I did enjoy it. I was actually going in to think it was going to be some sort of schlocky straight to video. I didn't know what to expect. I truly enjoyed it. I think it just suffers a little bit by being 36 years old. It's not its fault. So things that we take for granted today with our CGI and makeup jobs even today have improved. Like even our makeup jobs today are just that much better. Technology's improved. They're not sitting in the chair as long, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
All that being said, enjoyed the behind the scenes. Enjoyed the movie within the movie. I was pleasantly surprised by the acting of Brian Brown, the Australian actor. Very good job. It's just a couple of plot points. I think the idea was better than some of the execution. Some of the plot holes that I came across as a first-time viewer that I probably would let go in a second viewing where I wouldn't care as much. But just as a first-time viewer in 2022, there's some obvious plot holes that could have been corrected with a simple exposition. That's all. Just a simple, like him talking to that girl. They had a lot of scenes where there's some scenes they could have trimmed, too, where they could have said, hey, you know, he could have expressed more anger and more like, these guys are going to pay. And she could have said something like, that's not you. That's not who you are. It was something like, well, that's who I am now. You know, this is what I've become type thing. Like, I didn't know this was in me either. Because he full on rambles at the end, which I liked. He does it, though. He kills everyone in that mansion without even firing a shot. That's pretty impressive. You know, so he does use his magic, so to speak, to basically take out a whole gang of people, and that's what makes it very unique. Like, he kills all those people that were after him without firing a shot, and he gets kind of a disgraced officer on his side, so to speak, and they go off. I love how the officer takes the money, too. Denny's character takes the money, too. Great, take it.
Yeah, he earned it.
Highly recommend this film. I do want to see the sequel. I suspect it probably isn't as good, but I bet you it might be as fun. But I'm curious to see what they do. Like, what are they going to do for a sequel?
Yeah, the sequel is basically, it's almost a remake of the first movie with more Dennehy. Dennehy, in this movie, he shows up 40 minutes in.
Yeah.
In the sequel, it's more like, if you watch the trailer, they kind of bill it as like, it's a true buddy movie where Tyler and Leo are together again or whatever. But basically, it's the same thing. Tyler gets tricked into doing something he shouldn't do. He unravels a conspiracy and he uses his Hollywood trickery to make sure the bad guys get their comeuppance. It's a fun movie. It's not as good as the first, but I enjoyed watching.
The first one was a fun movie, yeah. I look forward to seeing the second movie. Would you want to investigate the second film later on this podcast? Or
Ryan, you know, one thing about me is anytime I can podcast without doing a lot of work, I'm game.
That up and, to me? Thanks.
Anytime it's an opportunity to podcast with you or Doug or Seiko or anybody on this network, really, assuming that my work schedule allows it, I'm there.
Perfect. Thank you, everyone, for joining us on an episode of The Last of the Action Heroes podcast, part of The Last of the Action Heroes podcast network. This network has podcast shows dedicated to Stallone, Schwarzenegger, Dolph Lundgren, James Bond, Jean-Claude Van Damme,
And
Bruce Willis and Steven Seagal has been covered pretty extensively now by the old 90s podcast. They've done a great job of doing him. They're on to other films now, but they did his 90s career, so they did a great job. Thank you so much for watching, everyone, and we'll see you on the next episode.